Hello, it's Wednesday the 29th of June and welcome to another edition of Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. A three-way summit is about to get underway between South Korea, the US and Japan on the sidelines of the NATO summit in Spain. Meanwhile, South Korea and Japan are two of four non-NATO Asia-Pacific states that are set to take part in the NATO summit to the displeasure of China. We'll have the latest details on the meetings for our news briefing shortly, and then we'll discuss the geopolitical implications for our in-depth today. And then coming up for Korea Book Club, we look at a short story collection by an up-and-coming queer female writer. We have all that and more on today's Korea 24. World leaders have now gathered in Madrid, Spain, awaiting the North Atlantic Treaty Organization summit. Before that, though, the leaders of South Korea, the US, and Japan are set to hold a sideline meeting, the first of its kind in some 5 years. For more on this story and the rest of the day's headlines, we have joining us in the studio KBS World Radio news editor Emily Jennings. Hello, Emily.
Hi, Jang-woo.
So today, Wednesday, in just a couple of hours, in fact, President Yoon Suk-yeol will attend a trilateral summit with US President Joe Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida in Spain. So can you set it out for us?
According to Seoul's presidential office, the three-way summit, the first of its kind in 4 years and 9 months, will be held at 9:30 p.m. Korea time on the sidelines of the NATO summit, which is to kick off in Madrid today, Wednesday. Now, the three sides are expected to discuss measures to strengthen their coordination on North Korea's nuclear and missile threats and enhance economic and security cooperation, among other issues as well. In particular, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the leaders will review ways of depriving Pyongyang of hard currency used to fund their nuclear and missile programs. When asked if Washington is seeking additional sanctions on the North, Sullivan said the U.S. needs to constantly look for ways to cut off the North's new sources of revenue as the North continuously adjusts its methods of acquiring funds. And he said the topic is something that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen will discuss with South Korea financial authorities when she visits Seoul next month.
So as we said, it's been almost 5 years since South Korea, the U.S. and Japan held a summit. Can you remind us of the last time they met?
Well, the last time was in September of 2017 when former President Moon Jae-in sat down with then U.S. President Donald Trump and then Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on the sidelines of the UN General's Assembly in New York. So this summit will see new leaders for each of the countries. Also, from 10 p.m. Korea time today, Yoon will attend the summit of NATO and its partners and become the first leader from South Korea to deliver a speech in such a setting. In the address, he is expected to stress strengthened international solidarity for freedom and peace and also call for NATO's continued cooperation on the denuclearization of the North.
Meanwhile, President Yoon has already been busy in Madrid. He met with the Australian Prime Minister on Tuesday. What did they discuss?
Seoul's presidential office said Yoon and Albanese discussed their commitment to cooperation on energy and climate change. Yoon expressed his hope that South Korean companies will participate in the green hydrogen sector alongside Australia, who are already very active participants, so that they can jointly cope with climate change. The two leaders also discussed North Korea's nuclear weapons program, with Albanese reaffirming Canberra's will to actively cooperate on the denuclearization of the North and a peace policy on the Korean Peninsula while continuing to strictly impose economic sanctions on Pyongyang. Yoon also called for Australia's support for Busan's bid to host the 2030 World Expo, to which Albanese responded that he would make appropriate considerations. And this is the first in a series of summit meetings that Yoon is scheduled to attend this week in Madrid.
Yes, we'll have updates from Madrid for the rest of the week. And let's turn to some other headlines now. South Korea has authorized the use of the first locally developed COVID-19 vaccine made by SK Bioscience. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so according to the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety on Wednesday, its final inspection committee approved the use of SkyCovine, also known as GBP510, after an expert advisory panel recommended its authorization earlier this week. And it was jointly developed with the Institute for Protein Design at the University of Washington in the US. SkyCovine is a recombinant protein vaccine based on novel 2 two-component nanoparticles that can maximise the immune effect. And it is the nation's first COVID-19 vaccine to have passed all three phases of clinical trials. The third phase trial of around 4,000 adults was conducted in six countries. That was Thailand, Vietnam, New Zealand, Ukraine, the Philippines and, of course, South Korea. Now, SkyCoVeen is designed to be administrated in two rounds with a four-week interval, and SK Bioscience will seek its addition to the World Health Organization's emergency listing and distribution through the global COVAX facility procurement mechanism for COVID-19 vaccines.
Now, this, Pats, comes at a good time because, unfortunately, we've been seeing an increase in the daily new COVID-19 cases in South Korea.
Yes, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency said on Wednesday that 10,463 infections were reported throughout the previous day, including 205 from overseas. And that brings the total caseload to 18,349,756. The daily tally increased by nearly 1,500 from a week ago, which is a huge jump. And it marks the first time overseas infections have surpassed 200 since February 1st. And some people are saying, you know, this is a cause of the eased entry regulations following the lifting of social distancing rules and an increase in international flights. These are presumed to have caused the uptick in imported transmissions, at least.
What are the numbers like for those seriously ill?
Well, there have been seven additional deaths reported, while the number of seriously ill or critically ill patients receiving care at a medical facility is down by three from the previous day at 59. And about 5.7% of ICU beds earmarked for critical and serious COVID-19 patients are in use, while the rate of treatment centres handling patients with mild symptoms is under 7%.
Moving on, nationwide monsoon rains have continued to drench the country, and from Wednesday night, precipitation is forecast to concentrate in the central region, including the capital area. So in other words, we're set for even more rain.
Yes, and we saw a heavy downpour of rain today, particularly this morning and around lunchtime. So anyone who is commuting to work, including myself, got quite wet. Did you happen to get caught out in the rain?
Yes, a little bit, but thankfully I had all the... Thankfully, I had an umbrella to keep me dry.
Yes, the umbrellas do work well, but it's quite windy, so you still get hit around your ankles.
Sure, sure.
And
it is
arms.
A bit of a struggle, but then I am from London, so I am used to rain and the wind.
Well, that's true, and I'm from the northwest of Ireland, so
exactly.
I'm
so
well
we are
used
okay
to
with
it too.
But still, there is a lot of rain we are seeing in Korea.
Yes, and there is more to come. According to the Korea Meteorological Administration, rainfall ranging from 50 to 250 millimetres or more is expected in Seoul and the inland areas of the eastern province of Gangwon until Friday. Also, 30 to 50 millimetres per hour of showers are in the forecast for parts of the central region starting Wednesday night, while up to 150 millimetres of precipitation is projected for parts of the Chungcheong region until Thursday, and as much as 80 millimetres are forecast for parts of Jeolla province and the Gyeongsan region. Meanwhile, mercury levels of 22 to 27 degrees nationwide are expected Thursday morning, with some areas along the east coast and southern inland regions likely to observe tropical nights on Wednesday, with temperatures staying above 25 degrees Celsius, so hot and wet.
And finally, amid the significant monsoon season rainfall, Pyongyang has yet to respond to Seoul's request for advance notice before releasing dam water to prevent flooding. Can you tell us more?
The Unification Ministry said on Wednesday that there was no response to Seoul's intent to deliver an official letter as conveyed via the military hotline the previous day when the two sides made daily communication through their liaison office in the morning. And with the onset of the annual monsoon season in North Korea starting earlier this week, there is a high chance that the regime will open its dams, including the ones near the inter-Korean border, in order to prevent flooding there. And during the rainy season in 2020, the North repeatedly opened the floodgates of the Hwanggang Dam on the western inter-Korean border, and that forced South Korea's border residents to evacuate. If South Korea is given prior notice, the lower dams can be gradually released in advance, and that will bring the water down so it's not a big flood all at once. And of course, as well, it's important to be able to tell Korean nationals to stay away from the water area when those dams are being released. So hopefully we'll get that notice.
Indeed. We'll wrap it up there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
President Yoon Suk-yeol is in Spain to attend the NATO summit. This marks the first time that South Korea, a non-member state, has been invited to the summit, along with three other non-member Asia-Pacific countries, which has led to China being riled up. Meanwhile, President Yoon is scheduled to hold a trilateral summit with the US and Japan on the sidelines to discuss the key points to look out for from Madrid. We have joining us on the line now Dr. Brad Glosserman, Deputy Director of and Visiting Professor at the Center for Rulemaking Strategies at Tama University in Japan. Well, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
So first off, can you sum up for our listeners the overall significance of this year's NATO summit? What are some of the key talking points and what can we expect to come out of it?
Well, the most important issue, of course, is to demonstrate Western or NATO unity in the face of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, to demonstrate solidarity among all of the members of NATO and the partner countries that you mentioned, the four Asia-Pacific partners, and there are some others as well, to rise to the challenge of the invasion of a sovereign state, to demonstrate their commitment both to collective security in Europe, to increasing their own defense capabilities, and then, and I think what will be the interest of the greatest interest to your listeners, is their awareness of concern about the potential for revisionist challenges or the threat posed by China in this part of the world, as well as perhaps other countries too.
Right. As you said, the summit will include the leaders of four Asia-Pacific countries for the first time, Japan, South Korea, Australia and New Zealand. None are NATO members. So what do you make of their invitation to the NATO summit?
Well, clearly it represents an evolution. And it's very, I mean, let's be clear, the fact that they are present at the summit for the first time does not mean that this is the inauguration of their relationship. I mean, South Korea has been a partner of NATO, I believe, since 2005. Japan's actually goes back to the 1990s. Australia and New Zealand both have equally long relationships, that of practically two decades. The foreign ministers of those four countries were present both earlier this year at a ministerial meeting, and I believe they actually attended another meeting as early as 2020. To begin these consultations. And what it just represents more than anything else is the awareness of, if you will, the unity of security threats, that distance is no longer an overarching consideration insofar as awareness that both countries in the Asia-Pacific need to be attuned to, alert to, and responding to dangers and challenges in Europe. And those countries, too, need to be equally alert and responsive to potential threats in this part of the world.
Right, as you said, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is the key issue hanging over the summit, as you mentioned. What message, though, does it send to have these four Asia-Pacific countries at the meeting, particularly when it comes to China, though?
Well, I think it sends a couple of messages. I mean, first of all, their attendance just individually suggests that there is a greater understanding of the unity of security threats, that it's impossible to argue that what's going on, certainly a crisis of the magnitude that we're seeing in Europe with the invasion of Ukraine, is purely a European problem. And of course, the four countries that you identified have responded in various ways with the provisions of aid and assistance, both physical, material, diplomatic, economic, for Ukraine and to the effort to restore the status quo and to punish Russia for its aggression. So I think there is, you know, just this notion that these countries are alert to and involved in that. But I think the second issue is, as a group, that there is a growing notion that the Asia-Pacific, there are like-minded countries in this part of the world that are acting both together, I think. And you know, the idea that there's going to be some discussions among them, not just NATO with the individual countries, but the various combinations of the Asia-Pacific countries with other NATO nations together, I think is an important indicator that there is an emerging, if you will, consensus and mindset about the need for collective action and to be thinking about these problems together and not merely as, you know, one country engaging a crisis on the other part of the world with NATO.
Right. With everything going on in the world, does this perhaps show that it is a shift in how the world is coming together for certain issues?
Well, without question. I mean, we've been dealing with an extraordinary evolution in security. I mean, just the fact that we talk mostly now about an Indo-Pacific rather than an Asia-Pacific is indicative of changes. But you're seeing the evolution or the creation of new mechanisms, strengthening of alliances, the forging and consolidation of other security relations, the emergence of China as a fundamentally different type of threat to many countries. All of this speaks to, and all of this, by the way, is overlaid across a whole series of challenges that have nothing to do with military, but are perhaps in the nature of economics and diplomacy, technology. All of this speaks to just a fundamentally different world that we are, quite frankly, slow to understand and appreciate and just beginning to respond to, and this is part of it. And if I to go on, by the way, and maybe to anticipate a question, I think one of the big issues, you know, we asked about, you know, what will come out of this meeting. What will really be important will be an understand or to see what NATO decides. It will be articulating its new strategic concept, which is like its grand vision and strategy for the future, and precisely the role that China plays in this vision and the degree to which NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which has historically focused on threats to the United States and Europe, and primarily Europe, but the United States too, the degree to which it now acknowledges and feels obliged to respond to the China challenge, to the international order and the international status quo. So we're all waiting to see what that document looks like and precisely what it says about the nature of NATO's relationship and thinking about China.
Right. China has voiced clear opposition to the attendance of these Asia-Pacific states, saying that the Asia-Pacific region is not within the geographical bounds of NATO, of the North Atlantic. What do you read into their opposition? How could it affect the relationship with those countries?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think China's trying to make it as clear as possible that it is very unhappy. And the disdain, the criticism, and it's been quite vocal. There was a comment about, you know, Europe's sewage flowing into the Indo-Pacific region and the Pacific Ocean, which is a pretty nasty way of a pretty just nasty comment. But it's clear that China is concerned. It's concerned about the possibility of both unified action by, I think, these countries within the Asia-Pacific region, as well as the prospect of greater unification between Europe and NATO, Europe and the Asia-Pacific. I mean, China's concern and China's preferred strategy is to paint itself as the benign country that seeks to undo imbalances and to respect rule of law and is a bulwark against, if you will, the excesses of the traditional hegemonic powers, which is its way of referring to the United States. And when failing to win that particular PR battle, its preference is always, as the world's second largest economy and one of the world, if not the second largest population country, to try to divide and conquer and to bring its superior size, strength, and capabilities to bear against every country, which it will exceed, with the exception of one. And the only hope that most of these countries have to successfully fend off Chinese predations and pressure is by joining together with other like-minded countries. And this is an indication that China's got its work cut out for it.
And there's also a separate four-way summit happening between these four non-member Asia-Pacific states. There was a lot of back-and-forth speculation about whether it would go ahead. There was some analysis that the countries were hesitant to go ahead with it in order to not to rile up China any further. But it is going ahead now, it seems. What do you make of this development?
I think it's positive. It strikes me that when you've got countries that are able to, you know, create like-mindedness, it's always easier to work as a smaller group than as a larger one. And so if you end up with an Asia-Pacific caucus, the Asia-Pacific Four, as this group is being referred to, within NATO, it makes a lot of sense for them to at least talk about the issues. If they don't forge common positions, but it strikes me as being just commonsensical for them to try to find common ground, to see where they agree, and therefore to maximize their voice within the larger set of discussions within NATO. But similarly, you would say that those opportunities for like-mindedness, for discussion, for sharing and articulating views, you know, plays out in non-NATO discussions as well. And so, you know, you've identified four countries that are American allies, and they have probably a great deal to talk about. both among themselves and with the United States as well, about common challenges. And every chance that they get to do that, and I think to find common ground is really, really valuable. So I'm a fan of that.
Okay, well, we'll see what statements and outcomes come from the summit and see how China and Russia respond as well. Meanwhile, later today on Wednesday, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol will have a trilateral summit with the US President Joe Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. This is the first such summit since September 2017. The three-way summit is expected to discuss responses to North Korea's nuclear and missile threats, security on the Korean Peninsula, as well as economic and security cooperation in the Indo-Pacific region. So significant issues on the agenda, but the meeting is only scheduled for less than 30 minutes. What do you read into that, and what do you expect from this meeting?
Well, first of all, the fact is that you're dealing with, you know, these guys are meeting on the side of the NATO summit, and they've got a whole lot of work to pack into 2 days, maybe 3 days of travel. And so the fact that it's only 30 minutes, that's about what you would expect from something like that. What you're looking at primarily is, I think, atmospherics. And you're sending a signal that the three countries are now working together and doing more to work together, as you mentioned, and try to overcome some of the issues that have gotten in the way of the cooperation that was taken for granted 10 or 15 years ago. You and I typically talk about these trilateral issues. And so you know well, and your audience does too, that the primary inhibition here and the primary obstacle is the depth of the mistrust and suspicion between Tokyo and Seoul. And so I think that the Americans have been pushing. They're pleased. I'm sure they're the primary motivating force behind this. And my sense is that, frankly, the Yoon government is quite pleased to be proceeding. And the obstacle now, for the first time, I think, in several years, the real issue for progress in trilateral relations is the Japanese government, which remains very suspicious. And also, quite honestly, is being inhibited by an upper house election in a few weeks. Once that's done, I would anticipate that you'll probably see a little more forward progress. But it's a very promising sign, and it's very much what I would expect. Again, you know, you bring these people to these large meetings, and you expect them to get together and to have these sidebar conversations that, if nothing else, send important symbolic messages of cooperation and of the need to work together on common problems.
Right, it's about getting the three leaders in the room together rather than perhaps agreeing on any significant outcomes or policy shifts.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the key here is really the NATO conversation and getting that straight. And then this just becomes, if you will, a building block towards what will hopefully be a more substantive trilateral top-level meeting in the months ahead, maybe at the UN General Assembly, or there'll be perhaps some other one of the East Asian meetings that would be later in the year. But I would expect to see this move forward relatively quickly once the Japanese are past their election in July.
Right. Despite this meeting, it seemed a separate bilateral meeting with Yoon and Kishida was a step too far, with perhaps, as you mentioned, the Japanese upper house elections in mind for Kishida. But there was a reported informal meeting between the two during the gala dinner on Tuesday. The two met for 3 to 4 minutes, according to Yoon's office. Yoon expressed hope for a future-oriented development of relations, and Kishida is said to have acknowledged the efforts being made by Yoon's office on that front. What do you make of this brief encounter? And as you said, you believe after the elections in July that relations could improve?
It's a grip and grin, as we like to call it. It's a quick photo opportunity. It's not much, and it's good to see. And we would be, it's notable if it wasn't happening. In other words, it's easy to say it doesn't really matter, which it doesn't, because what you just reported, both leaders are saying, is exactly what they've said now for the past several months. Since Yoon won the nomination for his party, won the election, it's been precisely the same language and the same hope. If they couldn't even go that far, then there'd be a problem. So now I think what we've seen here is just an acknowledgement that there is a common desire. And the trick is just going to be, quite honestly, the Japanese overcoming the intense suspicion that they have of the South Korean government. I will be very honest. I know many of the people that are in the Yoon administration. They are genuinely committed to a better bilateral relationship. And so I am hoping that the Japanese will not be too skittish and will pursue this as quickly as they can. I think it's going to be in everyone's interest, if, particularly, for example, North Korea is about to grace us with another nuclear test, as has been long anticipated. We're going to need to be working together to ensure that North Korea's ability to disrupt the status quo is minimized.
We'll have to leave it there. We've been speaking to Brad Glosserman from the Centre for Rulemaking Strategies at Tama University. Thank you once again for your time.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Be well. Be warm. No, be cool, actually. Don't be warm.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update.
The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 44.10 points, or 1.82% on Wednesday, closing the day at 2,377.99. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 7.16 points, or 0.93%, to close at 762.35. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 15.61 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,299 won.
You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We carry on now to Korea Trending, our daily segment looking at some of the other news stories that have been trending online. And joining us in the studio today is Walter Lee to bring us those stories. Walter, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jiangho. It's always good to see you.
Okay, so what topics do you have for us today?
Okay, so first we have an update on a story we covered recently about a case involving a family that was reported missing in South Chola Province a week ago. We'll also find out why the parents of a four-year-old boy filed a complaint with the police against a water park in Daegu. And finally, we'll also talk about the resumption of flights between Seoul's Gimpo and Tokyo's Haneda airports for the first time in roughly 2 years.
Okay, so we begin with an update on that story about a missing family. And sadly, it looks like it has ended in tragic circumstances. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so as early as 2 days ago, we did talk about a search that was underway for a 10-year-old girl. Her name was Cho Yuna, and her parents as well, and they went missing on Wondo Island in South Chola Province last week. Well, authorities that led that search said on Wednesday that they found bodies of three people in the missing family's vehicle, which was salvaged in the waters of the Songgok port in Wondo County around 12:20 p.m. Authorities retrieved the car after it was discovered upside down in waters some 80 meters from the port on Tuesday afternoon.
Right, the family was initially reported missing last week with a young girl's school in Gwangju flagging up their disappearance, but it soon became clear that they had in fact been missing since late last month. Mm-hmm. Have the police confirmed the bodies to be of the Cho family?
Well, they believe the bodies belong to Cho Yuna and her parents, but plan to confirm their identities after verifying fingerprints and analysing articles found in the salvaged car. An autopsy on the bodies will be carried out, and the family car will be thoroughly studied at the National Forensic Service.
So what have the police found so far in their investigations into the family?
Well, police in Gwangju suspect that Cho Yuna's parents could have suffered tremendous losses after purchasing Luna Token. That's the sister asset of the cryptocurrency Terra USD. After being issued a search and seizure warrant, police combed through the family's search history from last month and found that Cho's parents had searched for details on the Luna Token multiple times. And they also discovered that the parents had sought on the web information about sleeping pills and also ways to take one's own life.
Right, so it seems the parents drove their car off the port into the sea with the young child on board. Mm-hmm. It really is just an awful, terrible tragedy, particularly with such a young, innocent child involved as well.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, let's move on to our next story for today. What else has been trending?
Yeah, so it's a terrifying incident involving a four-year-old boy occurred at a water park in the southeastern city of Daegu. According to KBS on Tuesday, the boy suddenly disappeared into the water while splashing in a shallow pool at the park last Saturday. It turns out his left arm was sucked into the drain at the bottom of the pool because the drain cover was not closed. This drain was some 8 centimeters in diameter.
Right, so this young boy's arm was sucked into the drain and he became submerged underwater. Mm-hmm. What happened next then? Was he okay?
Yeah, fortunately he was fine thanks to his father, who immediately dived into the pool to pull him out. However, the boy is understandably traumatized and suffered bruises to his arm and shoulder.
Indeed. Do we know why the drain cover was left open in the first place?
Well, the operator of the water park said it has yet to be determined why, adding that it seems someone intentionally opened the cover. The staff are analysing CCTV camera footage to get some answers. The operator tentatively closed the water park and is said to be carrying out safety inspections in all of the park's facilities. It also belatedly installed a net inside the drain and decided to station security personnel at the pool at all times where the incident occurred.
So you're saying there were no lifeguards at the time by the pool?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's what the boy's parents pointed out when they filed the complaint with the police against the water park.
Well, thankfully, the boy is okay, but it looks like there are some safety oversight which needs to be addressed.
Yes.
Let's move on to our final story for today. What else do you have for us?
Yeah, so South Korea and Japan resumed flights between Seoul's Gimpo and Tokyo's Haneda airports on Wednesday for the first time in a little over 2 years. According to the Korea Airports Corporation, the route reopened with an Asiana flight departing from Gimpo at 8:40 a.m. and a Korean Air flight departing 20 minutes later. The two carriers will each operate Gimpo-Haneda flights twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays. Japan Airlines and All Nippon Airways will also operate such flights two times a week.
Yes, flights on this route were suspended in March 2020 due, of course, to the COVID-19 pandemic. Before mm-hmm. that, some 2 million passengers used the route each year. Mm. I believe that this route in particular holds a special meaning for the two countries, though.
Yeah, that's correct. So the route, which began operations back in 2003, is considered symbolic of bilateral exchanges between South Korea and Japan. Because of that, the Yoon Suk-yeol government had sought to reopen flights on this route from early on in its term. Seoul and Tokyo reached an agreement on resuming the flights during a virtual meeting held on May 21st. With the resumption of the flights, facilities at Gimpo Airport also restarted operations, these including the international flight terminals and duty-free shops.
However, despite the route being opened up, it's still not easy for Korean citizens to go to Japan at the moment, right? As they still have quite a lot of restrictions.
Yeah, that's right. So South Koreans can only travel to Japan if they are part of a tour group. Early on May 26th, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida announced that Japan will resume the entry of foreign travelers from June 10th. He quickly added, however, that tourism arrivals will be limited to guided tour groups in a bid to prevent the potential spread of infections. The move comes after Japan banned foreigners from entering the country for travel purposes in April 2020 as the COVID-19 pandemic began spreading globally.
Okay, so it's still difficult for Korean travelers to go to Japan, but it's certainly good news for the Korean tourism industry to be able to welcome more visitors from Japan.
Yes.
Okay, we'll leave it there for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, and we'll see you again next time.
See you next time.
Time now for Korea Book Club, our weekly segment exploring the world of Korean literature. We usually look at works in translation, but on the last Wednesday of every month, we look at more recent works that have not yet been translated into English to get a sense of the literary scene in Korea currently. And we usually do that with the Booker Prize shortlisted translator Anton He, but he is not available for another month. So instead, I'm delighted to welcome another literary translator, Beth Eun-hee-hong. Beth is a literary translator at Nabilera and a copy editor and co-host of the Korea Herald's Books podcast. And she joins us on the line now. Beth, hello and welcome to the show.
Hi, and first of all, thank you so much for having me. I hope that I can fill Anton's huge shoes today.
Well, we really appreciate you being on the show, and I'm sure you're going to be great as well. Let's dive straight in. What do you have for our listeners today?
So today's book is the short story collection, At Least Twice, 적어도 두 번 in Korean, by Kim Mella, published by Consonants and Vowels in July 2020.
Okay, so 적어도 두 번, or as you've translated the title, At Least Twice by Kim Mella. Now, in Korea, Kim Mella is widely known as a queer female writer, mostly of short stories. And in this collection, there are seven short stories altogether. Can you give us an overview of some of the themes that are highlighted?
Yes. So Kim is known as an up-and-coming queer female writer in Korea who in this collection delves into the themes of gender, patriarchy, disability, and queerness through characters who feel alienated in Korean society. And some of the most memorable characters range from an intersex character who must choose which gender they want to grow up as in Korea, a young woman who is charged for sexual abuse of a blind minor, and a woman who struggles financially and professionally as she discovers her queerness. And in an interview, the author has said, "The stories in this book are attempts to explain things that I cannot understand. And I don't know if that explanation was good enough and whether my intention to leave the unknown as the unknown was also well expressed."
Okay, so it seems she has taken on quite a challenge for herself then with some striking sounding characters. Can you delve a little deeper into some of those stories for us?
Certainly. So in the first story of the collection, Play Hormones or Give Me Hormones, we've yet to decide on the title. The main character is a 13-year-old intersex character named Gu Dorim. And just for context, an intersex person is someone who is born with a combination of male and female biological traits. Dorim has to choose between identifying as male or female in Korean society and getting the appropriate hormone treatment therapy and surgery to do so. So they, or Dorim, introduced themselves as Wing Forward Number 9, Muscadine, Charcoal Gray, and IS, IS for intersex. In this story, Dorim goes on a mythical journey to Itaewon to find a community of other intersex people like them. The title of the short story, by the way, is based on an actual 1987 song by singer Kim Wan-sun called The Dance in That Rhythm, Rhythm 속에 그 춤을, I don't know exactly the English
sure.
title, in which the author put hormones instead of rhythm in the lyrics. And the lyrics go, 리듬을 쳐줘요, which can be translated to play or give me the rhythm. So I think this really actually helps give some context to the story in that it does seem quite retro or nostalgic in its descriptions of Itaewon.
Right, I see. So it tells the story of a difficult situation for a child, but put it in a retro, nostalgic whole setting, as you said. What other points stick out from the story?
An interesting aspect is that the author refers to male genitals as mushrooms. So some of the most memorable and poignant parts of the story were also the quote-unquote advice that Dorim gets from another intersex character called Mr. X. Mr. X tells Dorim, quote, "Regardless of whether you're a man or a woman, the important thing is to have a lot of money because then people don't care which one you are." And I think this actually illuminates a painful truth about contemporary Korean society where money trumps all things, for better or for worse.
Mm.
And another devastating piece of advice from Mr. X that was memorable is for Dorim to, quote, "become fat like him if it was too hard to decide on a gender." He, meaning Mr. X, said that if you get fat, people don't see you as a man or a woman, but as just fat. This points to how fat bodies in Korean society are desexualized and rendered invisible, as lookism is very much a huge aspect in not just social but economic survival here. So to sum up, the greater theme this story gets at is really deconstructing the highly binary nature of Korean society when it comes to gender. The conversation around gender as a construct here is perhaps not as mainstream as it is in North America or Europe. So other than intermittent and mostly sensational or tragic stories of transgender people in the news, such as singer Harisu from the early 2000s, or more recently South Korea's first transgender soldier, Byun Hee-soo, there is still little discussion about queer or non-binary gender identities in Korean mainstream media.
Right, so it sounds like a very powerful story. I understand your translation of this short story is actually set to be published online soon, and in fact will be the first English translation of any of her work. Is that correct?
Yeah, surprisingly, it is the first, and I translated this for the upcoming August summer issue of Novelera, which is a contemporary Korean literature magazine for an English-speaking audience. And again, this was one of the most interesting pieces I've translated so far because of the wordplay that I mentioned and various nicknames that the author uses throughout, which is evident in her other stories as well.
Right, I imagine that would have been quite challenging as a translator, but perhaps rewarding as well. Let's talk about some of the other stories in this collection. What others caught your eye?
So the second story of the collection, At Least Twice, is a confession by a young woman who taught a 16-year-old blind girl named Ite what the narrator calls, quote-unquote, self-defense, or, again, another quote, doing a handshake with oneself, which is actually a code word for masturbation. The young woman also narrates part of her confession addressing an imagined figure named Yupago, a married male teacher who has a daughter. And it later turns out that Yupago is also how the narrator labels herself. I have to say this is one of the most shocking and morally challenging stories in the work, as it tackles the line between acceptable and unacceptable sexual behavior when the subjectivity and power dynamics between the two parties are so intensely magnified and ambiguous. The narrator also does commit a sexual act on her student, for which she is charged by the police. This is why she refers to herself as Yupago, in that she's aligning herself with a male teacher. I personally interpreted this as pointing to the endemic problem of child sex abuse in Korean society, as we can see from news reports, especially of Korean male teachers' sexual misconduct towards female students.
Wow, it is indeed quite a shocking subject matter, but it's also quite intriguing to think how Kim might have handled it. I believe the third story, The Material World, also contains some interesting wordplay as well and touches on some deeper themes of fate and superstition in Korean society.
Yeah, that's right. In this story, a young woman struggles to finish her dead-end theoretical physics thesis while being haunted by her grandmother's words at age 9 that she, the narrator, will be the downfall of her home. The grandmother apparently got this curse through the narrator's saju, which is a form of traditional Korean fortune-telling, which translates to the four pillars. It's based on Chinese astrology, in which a person's destiny or fate can be divined by their birth year, month, day, and hour. And the curse is a very specific phrase in Korean. The grandmother says that the narrator will screw up her household. Literally in Korean, it's 집안 많아 먹다. And I'm not sure if we're allowed to curse or say some bad words in Korean on this show, but verbatim, the grandmother says 집안을 말아 먹으면. So in Korean, the word 말다 can also mean to roll up. So the character works at a kimbap shop, literally rolling kimbap in a futile attempt to somehow relieve herself of her so-called fate. And she eventually finds a poster for Leza, which is short for lesbian saju, and starts a relationship with the saju teller. Leza tells her that at the end of the day, her fate is determined by the daily actions and decisions she takes, which is an empowering queer reimagining of destiny. And on a personal note, I just think saju and how much of an influence it plays in the character's life was one of the most interesting aspects of this story. As a Korean-Canadian who grew up mostly outside of Korea, I hadn't actually encountered saju until I came back here in my mid-20s and became fascinated with the whole culture of traditional Korean shamanism and fortune-telling. Mm. It was uncanny, you know, how Kim captured the way these saju tellers speak, touching on how, you know, certain hanja or Chinese characters in one's name can reflect certain elements like earth, water, fire, or wind, and how it affects your fortunes, like professionally, romantically, or financially. So I think it might be interesting to foreign readers as well who have never, maybe who have never encountered this kind of concept before.
Right. Yes. Of course, Korean people are very familiar with this practice, even naming their children depending on what a saju tells them. But I imagine it would be fascinating for non-Korean readers as well. Moving on, I understand there are also works that look at masculinity and patriarchy in Korean society.
Yes, that's right. I think that masculinity is really under the magnifying glass in the short story Hongi. The narrator of this story is a female police officer named Chungyeong, with a male cousin who cruelly kills dogs in his village. It tackles toxic masculinity that emphasizes brute physical strength and power over weaker beings. In this case, dogs, but women are also strongly implied. So we find out that the cousin inherited his cruelty from his alcoholic father, Jung Kyung's uncle, who also slaughtered dogs for a living. There's a really chilling line that's kind of reminiscent of Silence of the Lambs, in which the cousin describes how he likes to kill, quote, kill the prettiest ones and lets the ones with scars or the ugly ones go because the shock is greater. So there's also a strong connection to meat eating with masculinity, as the dogs that are slaughtered are used for dog stew or pochintang. So for me, it was reminiscent actually of Han Gang's novel, The Vegetarian, in which the main character retreats from mainstream Korean society and her designated role as a married woman by refraining from eating meat and gradually turning more and more plant-like, literally and figuratively.
Right, that sounds like another interesting comparison. Let's quickly look at the other stories. What else is there?
In Gathering Green Dots, the relationship of a married couple, Kang Tu and Hae-yeon, unravels around the mystery of Hae-yeon's relationship with her late high school friend, Mia. Although Mia went in and out of various relationships with foreign, as in non-Korean men, it's clear that she and Hae-yeon share the bond that is deeper than a simple platonic friendship. Reading this story made me wonder just how many marriages in Korea are like the one between Hae-yeon and her husband, Kang Tu, where so much is unspoken between couples and unspoken desires fester under the surface. There's also a story about brothers Sejun and Sebang in Sprinkler, which dives into how people can be affected their whole lives from traumatic childhood events and mentally unstable parents. And finally, in Ecole, the narrator is a woman who has been living in a goshiwon for the past 10 years preparing for a public servant exam, living a hopeless existence and dreaming to be a, quote, robot with an iron rice bowl, living a standard upright life. And she's willing to trade 10 years of her life for a, quote, unquote, ribbon, which signifies gainful employment as a public servant. So she eventually loses sight of her goal and begins eavesdropping on the woman next door called Ecole. And this is quite a depressing work that literally makes the reader feel suffocated, which is exactly the atmosphere the narrator lives and breathes. So for foreign readers, it's an insight into the lives of many Koreans who are desperate to gain a foot on the ladder of financial stability at the cost of their health and relationships.
Right, so these are some fascinating sounding stories that clearly shows the writer Kim Mela is someone who's very contemporary and daring. Can you tell us about Kim herself and her story?
Yeah, certainly. Kim Mela was born in Seoul in 1983, and her real name is Kim Eun-young. She has said in interviews that the inspiration behind her pen name is a secret, though some readers have speculated many theories about why she chose Mela, whether it be short for melancholy or melatonin. Kim herself has simply disclosed that she just wanted a pen name that was memorable for readers. In 2014, she won the Consonants and Vowels New Artist Award, which led to the publication of her short story collection, which we're talking about today. She has won the 2021 Munji Literary Award for Withered Leaves and the Munhak Dongnae Young Writers Award for 2 years in a row, in 2021 for Withered Leaves and in 2022 for Evening Glow. Withered Leaves, by the way, is Namunibi Marigo, and Evening Glow is Chanyeok Noel. Her short stories have been published in a total of 7 short story anthologies so far, but this work that we're discussing today is her first solo work.
Right, so she has received recognition for her works as well then. How mainstream is her work, though? It does feel like there is this new wave of Korean writers who are really pushing the conversation around issues such as marginalized people in society, particularly around gender and queer identities. Can Kim Mela be considered a part of this wave as well then?
Yeah, I certainly think that even if not in mainstream or traditional media, writers and artists in general have really pushed forward the conversation on LGBTQ and gender identities. And I saw Kim Mela herself live in person at a panel about queer and disabilities in Korean literature at the 2022 Seoul International Book Fair, which also features some other writers, Chung Yong-jun and Cho Uri. And at the panel, Kim Mela talked about her recent short story, Withered Leaves, which is a love story between a woman named Che, who has a physical and speech disability stemming from an early childhood accident, and an able-bodied woman named Angel. And Kim Mela said at that panel that Che is someone she admires and imagines really exists in Korean society. And this really impressed me, actually, because I see that she's a writer who is really trying to change the victim or, quote, minority narrative around LGBTQ and disabled people in Korean society, and changing it to imagining them as individuals with full subjectivity. And to your question, what's really encouraging is that this literature does seem to be moving out of the margins and into the center stage of international recognition. As some listeners may know, Anton Her's translation of Park Sang-young's Love in the Big City was long-listed for this year's International Booker Prize. And I also interviewed recently literary translator So Jae, who goes by they, them, who was the translator of the first full-length queer Korean novel into English, which came out in 2021. It's called To the Warm Horizon by Choi Jin-young. And in a sentence, it's about lesbians and the apocalypse. And when I asked So Jae how they found out about this novel, they told me about a website called Rainbow Bookmark. In Korean, it's 무지개 책갈피. And for those who are interested, this site really is a must visit to discover the world of queer Korean literature. I really think that this is a genre and community that will grow bigger and brighter in the years to come.
Right, and I'm sure our listeners will be eager to read your translation of the first story we talked about as well in the upcoming August summer edition of Nabilera. We'll have to wrap it up there. It was wonderful to have you on the show today, Beth. Thank you so much for connecting with us, and we hope we can have you on again soon as well.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Hello, this is Tiger JK of Drunken Tiger. You're now listening to Korea 24.
Next up, it's our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. And joining us in the studio now is our staff editor, Richard Larkin, to bring us those stories. Richard, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello. Good to see you too.
Okay, so where are we headed to first?
So first, we will look at the business section of the Korea Times. An article by Go Dong-hwan tells us about an annual conference for global startups that will be held in Seoul later this year. Try Everything 2022 will be hosted by the Seoul Metropolitan Government and will take place from September 21st to 23rd at Dongdaemun Design Plaza. Corporations and investors, as well as anyone interested, can join the offline event.
Right, I believe this isn't the first time that the government has held such a conference, right?
That's right. It was first held in 2019 under the title Startup Seoul Tech Rise and maintained international recognition in 2020 and 2021, despite the COVID-19 global pandemic. Around 1,400 global startups from 21 countries, including the United States, Canada, England and France, have participated in the event over the past 2 years. The conference has also seen some big names in different industries give speeches, such as former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, Alibaba co-founder Jack Ma, and Netflix co-founder Mark Randolph. The government has created the annual conference to help make the capital city a global platform for startups that need a financial boost and good business advice.
Okay, interesting. So what can those participating at this year's conference expect?
Well, according to the article, participating startups can consult with venture capitalists and accelerators for business cooperation and network establishment. It has proven to be quite successful in the past, as the city government reported that investment deals with over 57.5 billion won, which is around $44 million, were made during the previous two events. The city government predicts that this year's event will draw around 60,000 participants, both online and in person. Last year, over 53,000 joined the event online. Startups can apply for such meetups through tryeverything.or.kr from June 28th.
Right, for a lot of startups, it's all about networking, really.
Yes.
So this sort of event, hopefully, where they can meet lots of people, will be helpful to them. And hopefully it can help boost the startup sector in Korea currently as well. Next story, I understand, is about BTS.
Right.
It isn't about all the controversy about their quote-unquote hiatus as a group, but it does have something to do with their leader, RM, right?
Right. Next, we look at the culture section of the Korea Herald. We've previously talked on this show about boy group BTS member RM and his love for art. We also mentioned that he has previously donated some of his collection to exhibitions, and fans of the rapper have even created a tour of his favourite art spots. According to an article by Park Yuna, it seems that RM might be taking the next step by opening a space to show his art collection.
I see. I believe this announcement of sorts was part of an interview with the rapper about his art collection, right?
That's right. RM appeared on a recent English language podcast called Intersections, the Art Basel podcast. The program focuses on celebrities from various parts of the entertainment industry and their love for art. During Tuesday's podcast, he explained that his love for art started while he was on an international tour with BTS. RM said that he had a lot of spare time during the tour, so he decided to start going to museums in different cities around the world. He believes his collection gives him a standard so that he can live as a better man and as a better adult.
Okay, so what can you tell us about his possible future art show?
Well, the hint came as RM was asked the question, can the public expect a museum with your name someday? When answering, he explained that he has been planning on creating a small space for his personal connection, and according to the rapper, this was the first time that he had announced this publicly. RM said his reason is that currently there are not many museums or galleries in South Korea where people can see great Korean artists. He also hopes that the space can include a cafe for visitors. We don't know exactly when this will happen, but I'm sure the fans of the group will be excited when it comes in the future.
Sure, I'm sure fans will be flocking to it. We'll see when it does pop up, but it'll be interesting to see what kind of museum we see. We'll wrap it up there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us those stories, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you.
And that's where we wrap up our show today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye. Thank you.